A saturated state is a state in which the conceptual or emotional object has absolute value. That is, it is already somehow stuck or closed to new meanings and therefore cannot undergo any kind of transformation. An unsaturated state, on the other hand, is a state in which the emotional or conceptual object, it can be both, is in an open state in which it is still open to transformation, to new meanings, to all kinds of change. What I think is interesting and important is to understand that one of the most difficult aims of working with traumatic object is linked to this transformation from saturated to unsaturated states, because traumatic objects become fixed in a saturated state, which does not allow them to undergo any transformation within the psyche or within the therapeutic or analytic process. The saturated state of traumatic events or objects is a frozen state in which therapy is used or analysis is used to preserve rather than intervene. And this creates, in quite a few cases, a situation that I call false therapy or false analysis. A process, a therapeutic or analytic process, in which very detailed materials are ostensibly presented, but in fact they are presented in a way that forces the therapist or the analyst to either swallow them as they are or vomit them up, but not digest them, because they are presented in a way that does not tolerate any intervention, any other point of view, any creation of movement within the given frozen narrative.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Dana Amir. Dana Amir is a winner of this year's Sigourney Award. And for those listeners that are not familiar with it, the Sigourney Award is given to those who have made singular contributions to both the field of psychoanalysis and to the application of this work to the broader community. And I can't think of a better person that meets those two qualifications as Dana Amir and her work. And we're going to consider it today, especially around her recent book entitled Psychoanalysis as Radical Hospitality, Six Perspectives on Turning To Versus Turning Away. She has a nuanced way of listening to language as the musician she is and as the poet she is, that illuminates aspects of the experience of trauma for the individual and for the clinical dyad that is not only special and itself poetic, but in my understanding of it, a really key way to approach this work. Dr. Amir is a training and supervising analyst at the Israeli Psychoanalytic Society and a full professor and head of the interdisciplinary doctoral program in psychoanalysis and at the Zraman Postgraduate Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy Program at Haifa University. She is also, and this will become clear in her thinking, she's also a poetess and literature researcher. She's the author of 7 poetry books, 4 memoirs in prose, and 5 psychoanalytic books. She was awarded literary as well as academic prizes, including 7 international psychoanalytic awards, and as I say, including the Sigourney. I found it a deep pleasure in getting to know her work and in getting to know her, and I think you will as well. Here's my conversation with Dr. Dana Amir. Dana, welcome to the podcast. It's a real pleasure to have you on board.
Thank you.
Dana, the best way I could begin introducing your work on trauma and language is to start by quoting from the Sigourney Committee. In their awarding you this Sigourney, they wrote the following. Professor Amir's pioneering work has brought a novel and sophisticated perspective to the study of how trauma is conveyed in language. Her work portrays the traumatic lacuna as a melting pot of language that creates multiple forms of external and internal syntax. Her research delves into both perpetrators' and victims' testimonies, focusing on aspects such as word choice, tone, rhythm, and inflection. Through this approach, she encourages clinicians and patients alike to cultivate a poetic and lyrical sensitivity, one that focuses on the narrator rather than the narrative, thus shedding light not on the factual story, but on the unique way it is structured. We're going to be working from 2 of your many texts. The first is a paper you wrote called When Language Meets Traumatic Lacuna: The Metaphoric, the Metonymic, and the Psychotic Modes of Testimony. And in addition to that, we're going to be reading from your recent book entitled Psychoanalysis as Radical Hospitality. I can't tell you how each time I read that I smile. It's such an engaging, terrific title. Psychoanalysis as Radical Hospitality: 6 Perspectives on Turning to versus Turning Away. So, to start us off, you write in your paper, "The great challenge of analysis of trauma is to enable the transformation of the traumatic object from a state of saturation to a non-saturated state." To return to Freud, who argued that memory is produced rather than being revealed in the recounting, one of the questions that must be considered is how various modes of memory emerge in the analytic interaction, and in what way the analytic interaction can itself be leveraged as a transformative force that helps shifting from one mode of memory to another. I think that's such a key sentence that I'm going to ask you more about. In what way the analytic interaction can itself be leveraged as a transformative force that helps the shifting from one mode of memory to another. But before I ask you that, tell us about saturated and non-saturated states.
Okay. Maybe the answer to the second question is also embodied in my speaking about saturated and non-saturated states. I'll try.
Okay.
These are actually concepts developed in the Bionian theory. A saturated state is a state in which the conceptual or emotional object has absolute value. That is, it is already somehow stacked or closed to new meanings and therefore cannot undergo any kind of transformation. An unsaturated state, on the other hand, is a state in which the emotional or conceptual object, it can be both, is in an open state in which it is still open to transformation, to new meanings, to all kinds of change. What I think is interesting and important is to understand that one of the most difficult aims of working with traumatic object is linked to this transformation from saturated to unsaturated states, because traumatic objects become fixed in a saturated state, which does not allow them to undergo any transformation within the psyche or within the therapeutic or analytic process. The saturated state of traumatic events or objects is a frozen state in which therapy is used or analysis is used to preserve rather than intervene. And this creates, in quite a few cases, a situation that I call false therapy or false analysis. A process, a therapeutic or analytic process, in which very detailed materials are ostensibly presented, but in fact, they are presented in a way that forces the therapist or the analyst to either swallow them as they are or vomit them up, but not digest them, because they are presented in a way that does not tolerate any intervention, any other point of view, any creation of movement within the given frozen narrative. So in a certain sense, this is a narrative without a narrator. The goal of analysis or therapy, therefore, is to create an internal narrator that can intervene in the narrative, gain diverse perspectives on it, and perhaps even reconstruct this in a narrative. And the question is, how do we do that, right? So in many ways, the way to invite materials to transform, do you want me to say something about it?
Yeah, say how we do that. What you've just outlined is lovely and profound.
Exactly. That's a question. That's a million-dollar question.
How do we transform it? Well, we're going to go through some clinical material, but why don't you give us an overview?
Okay, I'll try. In many ways, the way to invite material to transform a saturated state to an unsaturated one is not through listening to the content itself, but through listening to how it is told. Content is often very tempting, certainly when it comes to traumatic content. But many times, if we listen only to the content itself, that is only to the details of the event, we miss other content that is embodied in the form. There is a vast difference, and we will speak about it later, I think, even when we speak about the other paper. But there is a vast difference between content that is told and transforms vividly as it is said, which is expressed in silences, in hesitation, in the feeling that the sentence is constructed in a lively way, and content that is recited in a highly eloquent but lifeless way. So the interventions that work in these cases, at least my experience, are interventions that direct the patient's attention to the way they tell the story and to the way in which the story itself becomes a window that invites us to look through it, or a door that invites us to enter through it into a kind of, the way in which the story itself becomes a window or a door, and the opposite states in which it becomes a kind of transparent wall, I would say, that leaves not only the analyst, but also the patient outside his or her own story. So that's a very, very huge difference between states in which we look into something vividly and states in which we found ourselves standing in front of a transparent wall. We can see everything, but we can say nothing or intervene in no way.
Does this bear some similarity to the old notion of a screen memory, a memory that disguises more than reveals?
I believe there is a deep connection to screen memory. I also worked with screen memories and what I called screen confessions when it regards the perpetrator's language. And I have shown in other papers of mine the ways in which the perpetrator disguises his intentions and responsibility for his deeds using screen language, screening language, or screen confessions. And I think that, yes, there is always, a psychic temptation, human temptation to screen. We are interested in not knowing, at least as much as we are interested in knowing.
Let's jump into the clinical example you gave. In one of the chapters in your book, it's called Parasitic Language. Let me read a paragraph to describe a very disturbing situation, and I'll ask you to elaborate on it. It's about a person you've named Jan, and you write, "Jan is the only son of parents who are both Holocaust survivors. Jan describes his father, a simple worker, as weak and worthless, while his mother, who came from a very privileged family, is described as brilliant, well-educated, and aggressive. The mother kept Jan close to her in a perversely intimate manner. On the one hand, she shared with him her deepest concerns and distresses. On the other hand, she repeatedly abused him. For instance, she used to stage scenes in which she would put food on the table without providing a plate for Jan. When he would ask for his plate, the mother would say, 'But you've already eaten. Now it's our turn to eat, not yours. Those who are sitting here have not yet had their meal, but you have.' She would leave him in tears and hungry, only to give him food hours later. Scenes of this kind happen repeatedly throughout the day, throughout his early childhood. He cannot tell whether his mother saw them as a game, however cruel and abusive, or was acting on a psychotic belief that he really had his meal, perceiving him as seeking to rob her of her own food." Can you say more about this?
Yes, I tried to say something about some details about his history and also something about how it was enacted in the transfers and counter-transfers and in the therapeutic process or analytic process. Jan was a senior academic research position, but he felt that his name was attached to achievements that were not really his. That was very interesting. He, at least as he perceived it, he falsified and blown up items in his professional CV and ended up teaching subjects about which he believed he had no proper knowledge. So he experienced himself as a fake. Mm-hmm. That is some important detail that I would like to mention. And another detail is that he had a history of about, I think, 8 psychotherapies, and each of which was marked by transgressions of boundaries when therapists allowed him to spend all hours of the day in the waiting room. For example, another agreed with his request to meet in a cafe rather than in his office. And Jan remembers, how quickly he learned what interested or attracted his various therapists by obsessively studying their body language, facial and linguistic expressions. He used to mechanically provide those contents that he felt that were attractive to his therapists, feeling loved or attractive for a moment, but then depleted, exploited, and abandoned. And it is very important because one reason for his turning to analysis involved the hope that the analytic setting would help him to turn inward and release him, at least to an extent, from his compulsive fixation on his therapists. Nevertheless, it didn't happen, and he actually experienced analysis as a torture, exactly because he couldn't see me and couldn't figure out what I wanted from him. And during our meetings and between them, he was obsessively preoccupied with me, and it was something that I experienced as troubling and even persecutory. And
you describe very clearly, let me read what you write about exactly that persecutory closeness, because you say it so clearly. You write, "In time, I noticed syntactic structures in his speech that resemble the way I express myself. This is an elusive, subtle quality. Jan does not crudely stick parts of my mode of speaking onto the surface of his. Rather, he quietly infiltrates the spaces of my language, adopting with sophistication and probably unconsciously metaphors that resonate mine, syntactic structures that are somehow reminiscent of my syntax. At the beginning, this gave me a vague sense of closeness, no doubt a vital piece of this enactment. But as his analysis goes on, this resonance causes a kind of distress, maybe even claustrophobia, as though something in this language familiarity constrains and suffocates me. There are times in which it even causes me to unconsciously react by producing language that is alien to myself in order to make a distinction, to differentiate, to create a space in which I can move freely. When Jan senses my withdrawal, he responds with outbursts of hate. This rarely happens in the session itself, but following a session, during which he felt that I broke the bond of similarity between us, he usually brings a letter which he reads aloud to me, one in which he mocks and humiliates me, slams things I have said. You go on to say, as long as we share the same language, he feels my thoughts are also his, namely that we share over and beyond a language, a common mind, which we both sustain. And as soon as I put on my separateness, and in a sense demand ownership of my language and my thoughts, I expose his dependency upon me and arouse his hatred. Again, a very rich description. Can you tell us a bit about both what you describe as this initial vague sense of closeness, and then that morphed into a more disturbing sense of claustrophobia?
Well, sometimes it's hard to detect when an inner state transforms from one to another. At first, I was very moved by his intelligence and even poetic language that resembled in sophisticated ways my language and my thinking. And yes, it somehow made me feel that maybe I can help him, that maybe this will be a turning point in his via dolorosa of not being able to be treated in any way. But as time passed, I felt, as I have written, in a way suffocated by the resemblance of his language and my language. And it was not, as I think you read aloud, it was not the case in which he is gluing parts of my language onto his language. It was much more sophisticated. The music was almost the same. And when I sensed, because I am very sensitive to music, when I sensed that in a way he's imitating my music, that was, I think, the point where I started to feel claustrophobic. And in a way, that was the point I really started to understand what parasitic language was. Because until that moment, I don't think I understood what he's doing. How he's sabotaging, in a way, sabotaging any relationship and also the therapeutic or analytic relationship. And that's what was the point. When I started to understand that he's, in a way, when he conquers my language, he also loses his language. I mean, that was the point in which I understood that in his inner scene, only one can live, only one can speak, only one can think. When he's taking away my language, my music, my thoughts, he's on the one hand making use of them, but on the external level, but in the internal level, he's losing himself. He's using my language to erase his language, to erase any possibility that he will have a language of his own. So it is very complicated. It's not that he erased me, he erased himself, but he did it using me as an erasing tool, as an erasing object.
And the distinction between what is more commonplace in analysis, for example, where there are periods where the analysand does imitate, does identify, does emulate the analyst and takes on various shapes and rhythms and manners of being as part of the analytic process, which becomes sort of the foundation for their own maturation. You're describing something much earlier, almost a fetishistic attachment to the experience.
Exactly.
With you. And the distinction is important.
It is very important, and I agree with the term fetishistic. And I think there is a huge difference between our internalization of our analysts' language, which we, and our parents' language, and any significant objects' language that we internalize. Because when we truly internalize something, it comes out colored in our colors. It's something else. It is digested, and then it comes out in a way that is, that has our color, our specific tone, our specific music. It's not an imitation, it's an internalization. But what he did was the opposite of internalization. It was an imitation, but of the worst kind, because by imitating, he also is erased. He is not saved as he thinks he is. He is not gaining space as he thinks he is. On the opposite, he loses all inner and outer space by doing that. This is a very sophisticated mechanism.
You write about it. One could say that Jan's parasitic language failed exactly at the job of killing his mother's phantasmic image of him. The mother imagined that Jan was herself, or the child she should have been, and Jan, rather than killing that image in order to be born as himself, obeyed the rules this image imposed upon him and went on maintaining it. Later, his attitude to that image became generalized and thus reflected in all his adult object relations. He transforms with almost ease into the phantasmic image belonging to any other with whom he comes into contact. This is his way of relating. He spots the other's image in order to become that image. Now, what's absent in your description of him and is the father both as a literal person and as an internal experience. Which one would ordinarily expect hope would offer some counterweight, some thirdness, some possibility of autonomy. What's your sense of A, where that was in his childhood, and B, where that was or wasn't in the treatment?
So it is very accurate what you're saying about the father. He was completely absent in Jan's childhood. Partly because he was a hard worker that most of the day was truly absent from home, and all the scenes that are described between Jan and his mother were in the absence of the father. But what was much more important is that the father was silenced by the mother in such a way that it was almost like Jan never internalized him as an object, as a significant object. He could say nothing about him. He remembered nothing about him. It was like a two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional image of the father. He could describe how he looked, but he never could say anything about who he was, the father, and he never knew who he was. The father also died when Jan was very young, but even before his death, and as we know, even after the death of a significant object, we can continue being in relations with him or her. In this case, there was no relations, so there was no third. The scene was a scene of Jan and his mother, only a scene of two people. There was never a third, not externally and not internally. And if you ask if that was ever mentioned in the analysis or interpreted in the analysis, yes, it was. And I think that it was interestingly manifested when my father died during the analysis. And I went, there was a break in the analysis because I grieved my father. And when I came back, Jan said something about never having any idea about me having a father. And I asked him what he meant by that, because it was a very weird sentence, not even being capable of thinking that I had a father. And he said something about creating an inner sin, phantasmatic sin, of course, in which there is only two people in the world, a possibility of two figures in the world, a figure of a mother and a figure of a child. And when I said something about my father, in the sense that I had to tell him that I had a father that died. It was a moment of, I think, that moved something in the analysis, in the sense that it opened the window for the figure of a father, even if it was my father, not his, because his father was nothing to him. My father, in a way, not in a way of telling him about my real father, but my father as a figure, as an inner figure, as an inner figure of mine, entered analysis and created, in a way, a space that couldn't be created before. So it was very interesting the way in which the father, any father, entered that analysis, but it was very late in the analysis. It was after a few years of analysis in which there was no place for a father of no kind.
There's a very rich exchange that you include in the book that I'd like to read between the two of you. You describe that he listens, as one might expect, to your online lectures repeatedly, avidly, and seemingly memorize them. And you put a quote in it in the book where he says, "It's like what you described as the, quote, function of the inner witness in your book. That's what I lack. I have no witnessing function. You see, I came to you because I read your chapter on the chameleon language. But it turns out that I'm here because of your chapter on the inner witness." You say, "Now you're doing the same thing with my language as what you had been doing with the language of that other woman researcher. You make your way into my linguistic patterns, i.e. chameleon language and inner witness, in order to be able to say something about yourself. But what happens is exactly what happened with her. The moment you adopt those linguistic structures, you as a thinker, you as a speaker, speaking subject, are lost. No matter how intensively I search for you, all I find is myself." It's quite a sentence. "No matter how intensively I search for you, all I find is myself," which leads to the issue of your countertransference, what it's like to be experiencing someone who is serving as a sort of a distorted mirror of you, and you're looking, expecting, have your antennae open to be engaged with another human being, and you get that. What was that like?
Yes, this is exactly as you describe it, looking at a distorted mirror, things. On the one hand, I said it and I wrote it. All I see is myself when I look for Yannick. All I see is myself because he's using my language and my image in a way, and my tone and my music. And on the other hand, I can't find even myself in that distorted mirror. It's not exactly that I find myself there. I lose also myself when I look at that mirror. So in a way, there is no way of any one of us existing in that kind of distorted inner and external scene. But you know, it brings me to the danger of working with parasitic language. I wanted to say something about it because it is, I think that Jan is an extreme case, but there are zones of parasitic language in any analysis and almost in any case we treat. So it's important to pay attention to something that I think that only can be revealed through the countertransference. At some point in the analysis, Jan started dreaming. He never dreamt before. In a way, we understood it as his mother being the only dream that he could dream. So he could not even become a dreamer of his own dreams because there was no space for his own dreams. But at some point in the analysis, he started dreaming very complicated dreams. And I, on the one hand, was very happy that Jan is dreaming. It is, you know, a sign of inner psychic life that maybe are awakening in a way. And on the other hand, I started to understand or to feel that I'm not sure that he's dreaming his dreams. Maybe he's dreaming my dreams. Maybe he's dreaming as well as in the same way that he dreamt his mother's dreams all his life, and something that was enacted in all his relations. Maybe he's dreaming the dreams that I wanted him to dream. Maybe he you know, brought me his dreams as a present. So I was getting more and more worried when he continued dreaming, because I couldn't differentiate between the dreams that he truly dreamt and the dreams that he dreamt as a present, as a gift, as something that was, again, mine and not his. And the only way that I could differentiate between those two kinds of dreams was my counter transforms. I learned that I react completely differently to dreams that he truly dreams and to dreams that he dreams and give me as a, you know, as a gift or as a, something that he did for as a present. When he brought to analysis dreams that I sensed that were dreams that he dreamt for me, or dreamt and felt that they were my dreams, there was something empty in them. Not the text. Again, the text was rich of the dream. The dream text was rich, but something, the music was hollow, was empty. And I sensed and I learned to sense when he truly brings me something vivid and alive. And when he, and on the other hand, when he brings me something that is very eloquent, very even sophisticated, if you look at it textually, but is empty of anything, is empty of, again, a narrator, of a dreamer. Okay, it was a dream without a dreamer. And the way of differentiating between dream with a dreamer and a dream without a dreamer, much like a thought without a thinker in Bionian language, was my counter transference. I could sense when the dreamer was there, and I could sense when the dreamer wasn't there. And I think it's very important in working with parasitic language to sense, always sense, when there is a narrator, there is a dreamer, and on the other hand, when they are completely absent. And then the text can be rich, could be even interesting if you read it, read it and not listen to it. But when you listen to it with a musical ear, you sense the difference. You know, you can know. Where is a music without a musician, a dream without a dreamer? You can sense that.
We will get to your relationship with music, which will include your father, in just a moment. But I want to include what you've written about metaphoric and metonymic ways of thinking, could include dreaming. You write, the term metaphoric testimonial mode refers to those areas in the testimonial narrative where there is a constant movement between the first person and the third person of experience, or between the experiencing eye and the reflective eye, further enabling the shift between the position of the victim and the position of the witness. Its metaphoric quality lies in the fact that, unlike the metonymic and the psychotic testimonial mode, this mode involves an active representation and the creation of new meaning, producing an integrated narrative within which the traumatic events are not merely repeated, but also undergo transformation. This goes back to how you began with your description. As against the metaphoric testimonial mode, the metonymic testimonial mode remains a first-person mode of report. It produces a text that preserves and enacts the traumatic memories and the traumatic features, and is thus characterized by the same sense of isolation, fragmentation, disorientation, and lack of coherence that are also typical of the traumatic experience itself. In that sense, the metonymic testimonial mode illustrates the very materials to which it testifies. Again, a key point, the metonymic testimonial mode illustrates the very materials to which it testifies. Can you flesh this out a little bit with some clinical vignettes?
That was result of a research that I have made as an academic researcher, and I researched hundreds of testimonies of Holocaust survivors' testimonies trying to differentiate between testimonies in which there was, in my terms, a function of an inner witness and testimonies where this function of an inner witness was absent. And there were two categories. There were actually four categories, but we are speaking about the first two of them. The first was the metaphoric testimonial category, and what I sensed that was important in the metaphoric testimonial model, and I will give an example in a minute, is that when you are using that testimonial mode, the whole testimony is in a vivid process of construction. It's not a static testimony that you, it's a static story that you tell someone, but you already know the story. On the contrary, you reveal the story while you are telling it. It's a completely different experience of the listener and also of the one who tells the story, of the witness himself, him or herself. And it was very different from the metonymic testimonial mode, in which there was no function of a witness, of an inner witness that was looking at what was going on and trying to understand what was going on. There was only an enactment of what was going on, with no one that could go out and look or understand or see it differently. And I have two beautiful, I think, examples of these modes. I would like to, can I read, can I quote from?
Sure, sure.
Okay. So the first one is the metaphoric mode. I will say nothing about the witness except that his name was N. He was Holocaust survivor. He was born at 1930. And the whole testimony, in his case, revolves around the lacuna of the survivor. So he was very, very preoccupied with the way he survived. And I want to quote a few lines of his testimony and explain why it is metaphoric and not metonymic. So I quote, "One of those moments which I want to tell, which were most important to me, is this. We were in the street, hunger, cold, and we heard the Germans' footsteps, so we ran away, and it seems they saw us. They come running after us, a man and me. And I, in innocence, totally stupid, but that's how it was, I ran home. That's what I know. But the house had two entrances. Two entrances. So I got into one entrance and I ran upstairs to the first floor, and he ran through the main door searching and also running upstairs. And there is this moment when both of us got upstairs, I from my side, he from his, a young guy, no more than 18 or 19 years old, holding a shotgun. And I'm sure he sees me and he does nothing. He turns around and goes away. And I went to that spot several times and I looked at it from all kinds of angles, whether the sunlight came in from the window. So it could be that the bit in which I am is dark. It might be that the sun came that way and he had the light in his eyes. Why didn't he shoot me? One of the questions, the many questions in my life. For me, that was a very critical moment. I don't understand, don't know." This is the end of the quote. And I think that this metaphoric testimonial text is preoccupied with the question of meaning. That's why it is metaphorical. The story is not told as a fixed, stable narrative. That happened and afterwards, that happened. It is as if in a process of reconstruction. The question why the young German did not shoot him, was it because he didn't see him or because he chose to let him live, is crucial because it concerns the arbitrariness of N's survival. Was it a chance slant of sunlight that left him sufficiently out of sight in that obscure spot, or the sudden compassion of the young German when facing the little boy? Was the fact that he stayed alive mere luck, or did it have something to do with who he was? This is something that is very important in this metaphorical testimony, because the witness does not know the answer. He asks the answer in a way through his telling the story, and he reconstructs and deconstructs the story over and over again in order to understand something that is about to be revealed but is not yet known. And this is a very vivid testimonial text. It is metaphorical because in that text you see the witness going into the event and out as a witness. He shifts from being the victim of the event and a witness that looks at the event from the point of view of a witness. And this movement, this constantly shifting from one position to another position, it's what makes the testimonial text metaphoric. It is in a process of vivid reconstruction. It is revealed through the telling of the story. It's not a story that is told. It is a process of telling, a process of revealing. So this is the metaphoric testimonial illustration. Can I move to the metonymical?
Yes, the metonymic, please. Yes.
Okay. The metonymical illustration is of A, again, born in 1934. Around they were both children when in the Holocaust, and A and her little brother and sister were taken to an institute of abandoned children in order to hide and save them. That's what people did then. And as they got there, the nurses separated them from each other, creating, in fact, a second traumatic fracture for the six-year-old girl, who stood by the door to the dormitory for hours in order to catch sight of her lost siblings. So I quote what she's saying, about 40 or 50 years after, okay, when she's a grown-up. She's saying to the interviewer, "And I stood at the door to see whether I could see my brother and sister, and that's how I stood near the wall without budging, but I saw nothing. For how long I stayed there, I don't remember. I feel it was a long, long, long time. Many days, maybe many weeks, maybe many months. I don't remember. Just the feeling of it being a long, long, long time." That's the end of the quote. Now, the fact that A's testimonial narrative does not adjust itself to her retrospective knowledge that this first separation from her siblings lasted only 5 days attests to the metonymical nature of her testimonial text. The time of trauma, we know it, is cyclic. It is not experienced as a linear continuum, but rather as an eternal present, unchanging, with neither a link to a past nor a connection to any future. This alienated aspect of time is one of the components of the experience of uncanniness that is typical of the traumatic experience. But when we see it here, what we see here is a 6-year-old child, that even when she tells us about what happened many, many years after, and when she knows the facts do not interfere with her story. When she tells the story, she is again a 6-year-old child that is telling only what a 6-year-old child can know. And this is what she's doing. She's taking us to a journey of a 6-year-old child, and all the knowledge that she gained years after is not accessible to her. She is a 6-year-old child. She's crying. She doesn't know. She's standing at the door to the dormitory forever. And this is her state of being when she tells the story. So metonymical testimonies are like this. They take us back to the psychic state of the witness, and to the state in which he or she were at the happening of the events. While the metaphoric testimonies are using the knowledge that they gained later, and we can see in them the child and the adult, and we can see a movement between the child and the adult. When I say the movement between the position of the victim and the position of the witness, in a way, this is the movement between the child and the adult that is looking at that child. Okay, but in the metonymic testimonial texts, you can see only the child. There is no adult.
Dana, my first choice would be to spend the rest of our time together discussing what you just did. But if we did that, we would not get to what I also would like to ask you about. And that is you. We all have our journeys that get us to where we are. Where you are, where you have gotten in your work is an unusual and dare say special place. And you are very revealing in this book that I mentioned, the Book of Radical Hospitality. You tell a number of stories about yourself. There's a very poignant chapter where you describe in great detail your experience of adopting a child from the Soviet Union, which we will not have time to get into. But you do reveal yourself. And in asking about you, let me start off by what you have shared with us. And you write the following. When I turned 8, my father, an experienced music teacher, gave me an ancient Japanese poem as a birthday present. Now, I invite the listener to take that in, because that is not a usual birthday present for an 8-year-old daughter. This is a poem from the 10th century, which I will read. The deer on Pine Mountain, where there are no falling leaves, knows the coming of autumn only by the sound of his own voice. I'll read it again. The deer on Pine Mountain, where there are no falling leaves, knows the coming of autumn only by the sound of his own voice. And you write, this was his way to tell me how he listened. Music for him was not a score consisting of sounds imparted from the outside in. It was more like a score which, in parallel to its external orchestration, was also orchestrated and performed within. More than that, he studied the musical qualities by what they resonated inside him. What he taught me through this poem had to not only do with listening to music, but also with listening to any score as such. This might be called the witnessing function of the voice. When there is no objective external signs, the deer, and much like him, the human psyche, will testify to events on the basis of the echo chamber of their own voice. Dana?
Thank you for reading this. It gave me back the poem. I actually never thought about it as beginning at that moment, you know, but you made me think of it as the departure point. Well, I can say that my becoming a psychoanalyst is deeply connected to what my father taught me about listening to music. Much of what I dealt with, as we already mentioned, much of what I dealt with in my psychoanalytic writing was about the relationship between form and content, or between words and music. And I think the way I learned to listen from childhood served in many ways as a platform for all my forms of listening in adulthood. I think that in all sorts of ways, this form of musical listening saved me throughout my life, at many points where the verbal or the external text was a dead end. Music found ways out and in. So for me, being an analyst is not giving up being a musician. It is another manifestation of being first and foremost a musician. And I think that psychoanalysis is about music, is about inner music. Even if we don't know it, even if we don't call it by name, that's what we listen to. That's what we react to, the music.
Before we close, thank you for sharing that. As I mentioned, there are other chapters in this book that we didn't get to, but there's one, the last chapter, it's called On Forgiveness. And the last paragraph of that last chapter, when I read it, and as the listener will experience their own version of it, I found it very moving. And without knowing you at all at the time I read this, I said, there's something important about this paragraph in who you are, was my sense. And when we spoke before this and I asked, would you feel comfortable reading this yourself? And you readily agreed. So I'm going to take that as a confirmation that this is indeed an important sense of who you are. And if you would share that last paragraph with us.
So do you want me to read it?
Please, yes.
I will be happy to. And yes, you're right. It is very important for me, this subject of forgiveness and this last paragraph, especially. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness is not only a choice. It is our most profound way of taking responsibility for ourselves and for others. And this means that however difficult this is to recognize, we have a certain responsibility for the suffering the other has caused us as well. This must not be understood as the masochism of turning the other cheek, or nor is it some confirmation of what is known as victim guilt. The point here is rather that being part of humanity, no one of us has immunity, neither from being on the receiving end of evil, nor from being its agent. Suffering has always been with us. Does it really matter in what form it comes? Writes Etty Hilson. The forgivable for her is not a singular action or person, but humanity as such, over and beyond its singular manifestations in individuals and their deeds. In terms of the departure point of forgiveness, we forgive not because the other's deeds deserve forgiveness. We forgive because the ability to forgive is the only antibody with which the human spirit can counter the unforgivable itself.
Dana, I have found your work to be of great importance to me clinically. I have learned, I have brought your thinking, as I understand it, to my clinical work with patients who are so afflicted, and my sense is my understanding of them and myself in relation to them has been deepened in ways that are useful to both of us. And I thank you for that.
Thank you so much.
Beyond that, we are not just clinicians, we are also clinicians. And your work has touched me personally outside of my clinical space. And I want to thank you for that. I can't quite as easily describe the ways that I feel enriched by reading your work, including being shaken, as I mentioned, your chapter on your adoption was challenging for me. If it's the kind of thing I wish you lived next door and we could spend more time chatting with each other and getting to know each other. Let me leave it at that. Let me leave it with a thank you, both from the personal me and the analyst me. And I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to letting more people know about your work. And again, the name of the book, which now, as I repeated for the third time, won't be a surprise for people who have taken you in this interview, Psychoanalysis as Radical Hospitality. Let's just leave that part of it there. It has been a pleasure. And thank you again. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for this radical hospitality as well.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.